Welcome to Low Violet. My name is Tyler Byrne. Today I'm interviewing Andrew Mack out of Asheville, North Carolina. He is the founder of Loblolly Press. Loblolly Press is publishing Emmett Inslee's The Computer Room. You can go pre-order at loblollypress.com. Andrew Mack is publishing his own book of poetry called Beast of Chase. One more thing, Emmett Inslee has started a Substack called Online, Again. All right, this is Low Violet here with Andrew Mack of Loblolly Press. I've been very impressed with Loblolly and like how you've rolled it out. And I'm sure it's been very difficult after like Hurricane Helene and everything. Like, how has that been? And can you explain like what Loblolly is and how you came up with the idea?
Yeah, Loblolly Press is we're an indie press based out of Asheville, North Carolina. It's really like my little baby. It's like something I've created from the ground up. We're founded in 2023, and we actually started with just one book, Earl J. Wilcox, The Surfacing of Joy. It is a great mentor of mine, a close friend, that he really just asked me to be the editor for his life's work, and I worked on that with him, and we ended up putting it, he wanted to put it together as a book, and then we used the funds from that to really start the press, and he asked me to just keep doing this work for other writers, and it's been a dream of mine my whole life, so I kicked it off with that, and then I just kept going. And then we picked up Clint Bowman's collection, If Lost, out of Black Mountain, really started honing in on the vision of the press that year. So we spent really all of 2024 figuring out who we were, publishing Clint's book. It did really well. And then from there, we've got, five total projects this year. Next year, we've got three books already set. We're looking at 2027. And yeah, I mean, obviously I think a big piece of what captured people's attention was our zine for Hurricane Helene relief. Of course, Clint's book comes out right in the beginning of September. Following that, 20 days later, Hurricane Helene hits. Obviously, I've lived in Asheville for 3 years, but I really do consider it home. And having all of Western North Carolina impacted in that way was very, very traumatizing. And I honestly felt like at the time, there's no reason for Loblolly to exist right now. Like, I need to focus on survival and I need to make sure that my community is doing well. So I had no plans of doing anything with Loblolly. I was going to take a break and just call it a year. And then a good friend of mine who I was staying with in Charlotte, my husband and I had to evacuate. So we're staying in Charlotte with a good friend of ours. And they mentioned that, it would be pretty easy to put together a little zine or something that we could use to raise money for hurricane relief. And out of that, my brain started moving. I mean, I have a 9-to-5 like regular job, but I had no creative endeavors, of course, while I'm stuck in Charlotte for a month. And I just thought, well, I'll just pick up three or four writers. I'll see if they can put something together. I'll contribute something and we'll have, like a 30 or 40 page little zine. I'll even hand print it and, upload it back as a Xerox and make it weird like a zine is supposed to be. And then I just put out randomly a call for submissions and got over 100 submissions. And then those folks ended up in the zine and I, spent a month and a half putting it together and we raised over $2,000 to donate to beloved Asheville. Yeah, it was an incredible experience. And I think that's where we gained a lot of traction on social media. I noticed people started reaching out and then we of course had an open submission period at the end of the year. So we got a lot of traction from that as well. Yeah, it's been a wild, beautiful ride. I mean, I love it, but I'm also I am Loblolly Press. You have two interns now, which has been really, really helpful, but it's me and my writers. That's what we create a sense of community and that's what we've been building for a few years now.
I was going to ask you if you had a moment of weakness and thinking about delaying it. And you said you did.
Being like, am I going to be able to do this? I think it brought into clarity a sense of, I am not having one person be responsible for my business puts us at risk. And so, I'm now working with several folks and having a team of people. Like I said, we have a couple of interns now, but also putting in place, what happens if I can't run the press, all of those things that I didn't have before. it was really enlightening in that regard. And now I feel like the press is in a much better place to withstand things like that. But it was tough. It was really tough.
So can you talk a little bit about Asheville? Because I know like people that live in Asheville, they really, really love it. Especially, and also like being like queer in the South, like how the dichotomy of that.
Yeah. Asheville is a place that I found. I mean, I've always known about Asheville. I grew up in South Carolina. So I was born in Lexington, South Carolina, and grew up in around Columbia area. And I moved around a lot for college and always kind of had this sense that I wanted to be in Asheville. I mean, I love the mountains, of course. And I had vacationed here as a child and actually ended up moving to Knoxville with a good friend of mine. And after it was around the time of COVID, right? We all lost our jobs and those things happened. And so life took a big turn for me. I was living in Michigan at the time, moved to Knoxville. And that's when I met my husband and he lives here in Asheville. And that was it was over 3 years ago. And it felt a little bit like fate in the sense that I was like, I've always wanted to be in Asheville and this is where he was. And so we dated long distance for about 6 or 7 months and I decided to move here. We actually moved in together and then we've been here since in the same apartment. I love it. Asheville is a place where art feels alive all the time. And I haven't lived in a place like that ever in my whole life. And of course, Helene like took a great, great toll on that. And it you know, was really, especially the River Arts District being destroyed. But I actually think a lot of what makes Asheville a place that people want to be and a place that people want to make art is like the artists that are here. And we have great community. For example, like Clint, who I mentioned, we published his book, but he, you know, he really is like a pillar of the literary community in Black Mountain and has founded the Dark City Poets Society, where once a month you can go and meet with a group of sometimes like 20, 30 people to critique your work. Like you can bring a poem and you can have it critiqued as like a regular workshop. It's completely free and it's run out of the library in Black Mountain. Incredible. And then they do a reading once a month as well in Black Mountain. So mm-hmm. I just haven't lived in a place before where I could access literary community or artistic community in that way. And as someone never been to an MFA program, my degree's in English from Winthrop University, a small university in South Carolina. But yeah, I'm really been happy to have a sense of artistic community, literary community, and part of what keeps me here.
And what brought me to start looking at Loblolly is like I participate online, like this group or publishing press or like online activities called the Shabby Doll House. And that like Emma Inslee, like she also participates in those activities. And then I saw she was getting published and then I started looking at Loblolly. And it sounds like your story almost kind of like parallels with her because she moved from Chicago to Asheville and then she met her wife Kay and they got married this year too.
Yes, they did. Yeah, it's a little bit of a parallel. I mean, I love Emma. We're publishing Emma's book at the end of this year in September. Yeah. And it's truly like one of the, I honestly think a big part of why the press has grown is because people are really excited for this book. And it's, I mean, they should be. It's incredible. And I'm so excited for her to be able to share it with the world. Yeah, she's great. I really love working with her.
Does it feel cool to be working with other queer people?
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't speak to that at all when you asked it about being queer in the South. But I think about it a lot. I mean, I especially right now in the political with the political environment that we're in, that living in the South and being queer is actually we've always been a target. And I don't see it as like a feeling that this is a new thing for us, that we've been through this before. I mean, yes, just not sure that we were ever safe. I remember living in Knoxville and feeling like Knoxville, especially, I felt like because it's a college town and it did not, it's very, very Southern and very conservative. Mm-hmm. And it felt a lot like Garrison and I, my husband, would not like hold hands walking downtown in Knoxville. It just didn't feel safe in that way. And I think that's what a lot of queer people have to do is hide behind, you know, their mask or their faith, whatever you want to call it, to be able to make it here. I say all that. And then I think people are like, well, why would you be here then? And I struggle with that answer sometimes, except to say that the air feels right here for me, like the trees mm-hmm. feel right here for me. When I'm here, I can write. I can be creative in a way that I can't anywhere else in the world. And moving away from here would be like losing a piece of myself. So when you have that connection to place and environment, I even if you know, if push comes to shove and the world truly becomes a dangerous place here for me and my family and my close friends, of course we will make other plans and we'll find a way to get out and we'll find a way to be happy somewhere else. But there's something to be said about staying here and also knowing that just by being really visible, I would say like I'm a queer man, I'm gay, but I'm also like cisgender and I'm white and I have these kind of layers of privilege that I think in some ways allow me to be really visible in the community in a way that I wouldn't expect maybe other folks who have less of those privileges to want to be or to even be able to be visible that way. And so staying here for me is a part of, especially right now, I've really felt motivated to do this now is like I want to be as visible as possible.
Mm-hmm.
to give other people that space to feel like they can come in, you know, behind that and also be visible too. It's just really important for them to see us right now.
So I want to ask about you, like your interest in literature and coming up and growing up, like who were you first interested in, like in school?
I didn't know that. I mean, I've always liked reading, you know. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of folks will say that I was a big reader as a child. I grew up reading a lot of fantasy, of course, you know, like Harry Potter. Like I read these fantasy books called Pendragon when I was growing up. I just like loved like all of the fantasy that was coming out at the time I was in elementary school. But I think I really started getting interested in literature because I had my sophomore English teacher. Her name was Claire Robinson, incredible person, but she an incredible teacher. And she gave us these stupid like quiz. We'd have to read the book and then she would give us like these very difficult quizzes where you would have to like quote the book. And she'd be like, what's on like this page and in this chapter, quote what this person said. I mean, I of course failed several of them, but I remember this kind of like motivation to read and be good at it kind of like kicked in. And we read A Tale of Two Cities, of course. I think most high schoolers do read it. And I just had never read an old, quote unquote, an old book and felt like, wow, this is incredible. And I did when I read that book and it kind of just sparked this thing in me. And I was also really into graphic design in high school. I really thought that's what I was going to do. I was going to go be an artist. I was going to be a graphic designer, or I was going to go be a teacher or something. And post that, I was like, maybe I'm a writer. And I went to Winthrop, but my degree is just in English, but I, you know, wrote the whole time I was in college. Of course, none of it has ever surfaced, thank God. And I've continued writing after that. Yeah, I love to read. I would say like that when I found my stride as a reader and as a writer, I found my way into Southern literature, I think through ways that most folks do, where, reading Faulkner or reading Flannery O'Connor, and then found myself kind of my senior year of college wanting to really specialize in that. So I ended up writing my honors thesis on how the environmental collapse of the South in the second half of the 20th century mirrored some of what the writing was saying about the personality of the South and the people there feeling less and less strong in their identity, that they didn't understand kind of who they were, and also then matching the economic collapse of the region as well. And so reading, you know, 12 books to write that thesis, and ended up writing it on, I used Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood, and I used Larry Brown's book Faye, and just tracing the two protagonists as travelers in that, and comparing that over the course of 50 years between them when they were written was a thing that later I was like, well, that's probably what I want to be writing about, and so that's what I do now.
Can you talk more about that? That's super interesting.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I will say it's been a long time since I've been in college, and I haven't read that thesis in a while. But essentially you've got Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood, which is the story of Hazel Motes, who, you know, and forgive me, I'm not going to remember all the details, but I haven't read it in so long, is essentially like this traveler throughout the South, right? And as he's traveling, he's a prophet, and he's, you know, sharing all of these things. And as he's doing that, his identity completely changes. And then you get like 50 years later, you know, or six, I guess 40 years later, because it's written in the 90s, Larry Brown, who's writing about Faye, who is his protagonist, who's doing something very similar. I think I remember a bit more about her, but she is essentially loses her entire family and ends up wandering the streets, like literally like the streets of the South, you know, rural, hitchhiking everywhere, falling in love, ends up getting involved in a murder somehow. I mean, it's a huge, the novel could have been, surely needed a stronger edit. Like there's way too much going on. But at the core of that is this feeling of like emptiness that she has. Whereas like I compare that to Hazel Motes in Wiseblood, where he, even though his identity changes, he's full of things, you know, he knows who he is in that sense of at the end of the novel. And Faye always felt very much like she'd been emptied out by society. And I use some data from like the National Forest Service to show that oftentimes when we gut the environment around us, so when we clear cut trees, and I grew up around a lot of pine tree farms, I'm from the Midlands of South Carolina, when we gut all of those things and we're left with just an empty landscape, that also begins to reflect our region, but also who we are as people within that region. And so we lose a sense of who we are and lose a sense of identity because we are looking around and our place looks like everywhere else. So you have like Faye walking through when she's wandering through the streets. When I say streets, I mean, you know, empty clear-cut fields and strip malls. That's the whole scene that you're seeing. Whereas Hazel has these opportunities, and I'm also maybe conflating Flannery's first novel, The Violent Buried Away, and her character there, of being able to like go into the woods and into the trees and have these revelations about who they are. Of course, it's an incredibly dangerous place when they do go there. But they still get to go there and have these things. But when we don't have that anymore, well, what are we? Who are we? And what do we have? And yeah, it's just fascinating to me. I think I still, in my poetry now, am writing about that. I keep writing about it.
So talking about that, do you see a parallel between that and then the hurricane and the aftermath of the hurricane? Like, it should be important to build up like actual community things instead of like McDonald's or Burger King's or stuff like that.
I have a huge fear that we're going to lose the entire River Arts District to gentrification. And we already were, but to now see, and of course, I'm not on the city board. I don't know what's going on down there right now. I do know that some of my favorite artists and my favorite local businesses were decimated and are gone. And I'm concerned that what's going to be built in its place, as you said, are going to be these things that look like everywhere else. I was talking to folks after the hurricane happened and realizing that district, the River Arts District, is, you can call it a tourist area, whatever you want. It was also for the locals. Like, we spent a lot of time there as people. And the thing that made you want to be in that place is it had this sense of character and of a little bit of grunge and a little bit like people were still writing and creating and doing things there and creating culture, right? I'm so sad that it's gone, but there was a movie house. And I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name of it. I will have to look it up. It was a small movie house in Asheville, and it was a place where you could go see like a indie film or just I went to see Barbie there, but it was there were tiny little theaters. And yeah, that kind of feeling of like, now I can go out and be a part of a artistic community. Yeah, of course, I'm concerned that that's going to be gone. I don't have an answer for it, except to say that I also am now part of that artistic community and what I see Loblolly doing. And we published, you know, folks from all around the South, but I mean, our first two of our three books that we've really put out are from folks in Asheville. We have Clint, Black Mountain, not Asheville proper, but nearby in Buncombe County, and Emma, of course, publishing hers in Asheville here, not too far from where I am. I feel like we are, I don't know, maybe it's like a little bit, I hope this doesn't sound like a lot of ego or pride, but we are part of that foundation of the community now. And I have to think that that's a little bit of, I have a little bit of hope in that, and that we live in an age when we can do that. Like, we can be artists on the internet and have our place as well and have it go out there and reach other people, which I think is what happened with Understory.
I sometimes go on the Reddit boards on Asheville just to see like what's going on over there. And there's like this giant like mansion, this like opulent decadent mansion. And I was just wondering, like, is it weird to have that juxtaposition of people getting thrown out of their like houses and stuff? And then you have this giant mansion that like, why can't they just put the people in the mansion?
Yeah. I mean, we've got Grove Park Inn, right, which is the kind of very, very expensive, very swanky hotel. I do think that North Asheville area and the places around it have always been kind of where the wealthy live, but I'm not sure that there's any city you go to where that doesn't exist. It's a, I always think of, maybe this is going way too far, but thinking about St. Louis, and I know you're in kind of the central area of the country, and
I live in Tulsa,
So I was thinking of St. Louis and how that city is literally cordoned off. Streets are cordoned off for these large, large houses that are like, you know, they're the places where rich folk live. And yeah, I think that that's just like part of the fabric of our environment. But I will say, I don't ever feel like those folks are the ones that I see around town. Yeah, no. I don't feel like, I mean, I will say I wish that there was, I do wish that there were more solutions for unhoused folks in our community. I wish that there were more solutions for folks who have lost their homes due to Helene. But I have really seen the community come together. I think of like Beloved Asheville is who we donated our funds to for our zine. And they're literally they're buying land and building tiny homes for people to live on.
Oh, that's like, awesome.
Incredible. And so I think those things do exist. And I don't mean to keep bringing it back to this sense of hope, but I think when you live in a world where I do feel like our sense of scope is so wide and that it's so daunting all the time to be thinking about what's going on nationally and then internationally as well, that when you get down to your local community, it feels more hopeful. It feels more approachable. There are things that I can do and act on here that I don't feel like I can do on any other level.
Well, it sounds like the zine saved you and it's kind of saved the press.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we made no money off of it. So, you know, we're still kind of looking for like we always want to be thinking about how do we maintain the financial stability of the press. But I didn't want to make any money off. I mean, I wanted to make money in the sense that I wanted to give it away. And I was so happy. It was so like pressing that button that day of giving it away. I mean, I was giddy walking around the house because I just knew that it was going to go to people who really needed it. And also really, like, I think the caliber of the art that's in the zine is pretty good. Like, I'm really proud of what we put out. And I designed it all myself and did it in like 3 days because I was about to be on deadline and I had to get it out. And doing it digitally really helped. But something I'm excited about is that we're going to be putting out a paperback version of it really soon.
Oh, sweet.
So we're probably going to launch on pre-order for it next month. We're not planning on printing more than what we get on pre-order, just we want to be environmentally conscious and sustainable. But if folks are interested in actually having their hands on something instead of just the ebook, it really is, it's 200 pages. It's going to be available for a really affordable price. And I think that it's, you know, it will continue to give to our community in a way that will help sustain us in the future.
Do you think this is something you'll do annually?
It's something I'm considering and I don't want to like commit to doing it just now. Again, I'm just, I have a lot, like I have a lot going on in my life, but also Loblolly is huge in my life. And if I was going to do a yearly magazine, I would love for it to be very intentional in how it's done. And I would like it to be really, really, really well done. And I don't know if I could handle the level of submissions that would be, you know, monitoring submissions and doing a lot of the legal work that it requires. It just takes a lot of time and energy. And right now what I'm focused on is our press putting out really good books, like really well-designed, really critically good books. Yeah.
You said when you were growing up, you thought about being a graphic artist. What art inspires you?
What art inspires me? This is, I wish that I could give you like a real artist that I love, but actually what art inspires me is how words sit on a page. Like I love that kind of level of taking, like seeing a, well, I can even show you. It's like I'm working on some of my poems right now and I will print them, or I'll write them. And then I'll just sit down and circle and move things around. I'll actually cut them out. That feeling of like space is just so beautiful to me. So I like a lot of, art that is, I would say like found art where it's like, you know, snatched out of a page somewhere, put somewhere else and in a new context. It's really beautiful.
Yeah. Do you obsess over like book covers?
Yeah, I mean, you should just stare. You could like look at my Instagram for 5 minutes and it's like primarily book covers that are by. And yeah, I am. I would say that book cover design is really, really challenging for me. It's something that I really, really have to fight for. Emma, we're publishing her book, The Computer Room, but she's a really amazing graphic designer and has been working on our covers. And you can tell they're really, really beautiful. But I do all of our interior book design and I'm really proud of how I'm so excited. We're putting out Distant Relations is a book of poems by Cheryl Whitehead coming out next month. And I'm really proud of how that book looks on the inside and the outside. Like, I think it's going to be beautiful. The way that people hold it in their hands is going to be super high quality. And yeah, something I'm really proud of. It's gorgeous.
Do you want to read one of your poems?
I just finished my next chapbook. So I haven't published a book since 2020, and I've been working on my full length for the past 6 years, but I'm publishing a chapbook next month that I've been working on for a little bit less time, but I'm just really excited for it. It's been fun to write. It's about a history of black bear hunting in North America, and specifically Western North Carolina. And I say that as if it's like it's not a historical retelling, but I do trace some of the language of Teddy Roosevelt's Hunting the Grizzly, which is a book that he wrote about essentially hunting in colonizing in North America, and specifically the U.S. And I start there and I kind of end in present day, all the way up to Helene. This poem is called The Bear. It's the last poem in the chapbook. At first light, the sun bends across the dried riverbed, mud cracks, a hard red skin indented with tracks, a soft splay of bear pads. Moving south, the bear shifts her weight, two cubs weaving between her legs until the snap of a branch, and then the scent, rust and pine sap, the sound of a stomach gurgling. She stiffens. He raises his rifle slowly and feels the weight pull against his shoulder, down, down, steady, like his father taught him. A breath, the bear turns to face the man, sniffs the air. There are some things older than hunger.
I really like that.
Thank you.
So you chose bear hunter? Like, what does that like speak to you? How do you get into that?
I'm not a bear hunter. I don't agree with hunting ethically in any way. And it comes across, I think, in the chapbook. But I went on a hike with Clint, actually, in maybe September 2020. Yeah, it was a long time ago. It's like 2 years ago. And we were supposed to hike to the top of a mountain. And of course, like, we get a mile and a half in and we see kind of in the distance a dog kind of coming down like from the top of a hill on kind of running down toward us. For what it's worth, I have a dog, Penny. I love her. She's lovely. I don't typically like dogs though. And so I see this dog coming and I'm like, oh no, what's going on? And the dog comes near us and is just completely malnourished, obviously starving, has had no water, and has a huge collar on with a GPS tracker and an antenna sticking up from it. Clint begins to educate me on the fact that this is like a bear hunting dog and that it's been released to hunt bears. And that what we discover is that this dog has just been left to die. Like, it has been left out by the owners of it to not return, I suppose. It's not on any like hunting trip. So we called the number on the collar, and I just will never forget like the kind of lack of concern and the lack of care that the owner had. And also like my sense of fear that what was I going to do when I did meet them and decide to give the dog back to them? And we tied a piece of peacock around the dog. We gave it whatever, like from our lunch that we could feed it. We both had water. We tried to create like a bowl to give it some food, like a food and water. And I think the dog was just completely, suffering. And so we walked, we called them and we decided to meet them at the trailhead, and we walked the dog back. And on the way, Clint and I kind of had this discussion of like, we should keep her. Like, we should not let her go back to these people because this is abuse. And then we arrive and they're sitting there on their truck with their cages with the dogs in the back, and they've got like a gun and they're holding their hands on their gun. Mm-hmm. And there's no choice for us at that moment, especially, I will say this, you mentioned kind of queerness in the South. Like, me being in a rural area, and hiking, perhaps I could pass as straight, maybe, if I really tried. But typically I wear really flamboyant clothing and I look gay in public, I look queer. And I was just like nervous for my own safety. And honestly, I was like, we can't, like, there's nothing we can do. We have to get this dog back. So that experience really, really impacted me And that kind of started my thinking about what is this weird thing about humans where we hunt for sport and we hunt because we're interested in, and there was always been this relationship between humans and animals that is predatory. You know, we think of ourselves as separate, but maybe we're like more part of that than we think. And to me, there's like some utility at times to that, where we hunt to eat. Of course, I'm not a vegetarian. Like, I eat meat. I understand that relationship. I don't understand and want to explore more this relationship between hunters and the hunted. And then I use that in the chat book as kind of a metaphor for where we are right now. It's like, I often feel like, and my community often feels like, the hunted where we are. And I don't understand why. I don't know why we are that way, or why we decide to kill things for what appears to be no apparent reason. Yeah.
Do you think those people in the truck are like performing their identity in some way by like having guns like on their hips? I was just, my mind started going to like being gay and like going to a drag show and they're performing a certain identity. I was wondering like if rednecks like are performing their over masculinity and trying to appear a certain way.
Could be, you know, I think if we think of clothing or what we put on our bodies as a representation of our identity, but also our gender and our, what, I mean, all those things, like our region, all those things that make up who we are. Yeah, absolutely. I do think they, I'm not sure that they intended to intimidate us. I will say that. I think they probably were just existing in their world. And honestly, maybe we were in their world. That was their place and we were in it. Yeah, I think that they probably are doing that, but in the same way that the rest of us are too.
Is that the strangest thing you've encountered while hiking?
I've done a lot of hiking. I used to lead hiking trips for teenagers on the Appalachian Trail.
Whoa.
Yeah. I did have this experience one time where I hiked for a week in one part of the Appalachian Trail up in New Hampshire. And then 2 weeks later with another group, I was in Maine. And I met the same man, like he had like caught up to us in the exact spot we were staying, which like the likelihood of that happening to me was just, it has to be so, so, so small. And I had this really long conversation with him around the fire, and he was kooky and crazy. I think a lot of people, you know, hike the AT for a lot of different reasons. And yeah, he was just a wild character. So that is a good example of like, you do meet these people that are incredibly interesting when you're out in the woods. And it is this kind of, I grew up around rednecks. My family, they are rednecks. Like, mm-hmm. I don't consider myself separate from that. Maybe that's not an identity I put on right now, but I mean, I can do my country accent and my Southern accent with the best of them. And I love, you know, the Southern food and all those things. There's something about meeting in the woods that makes us, maybe it's like a liminal space. Like, maybe it's a place where we can interact in a way that we feel maybe wouldn't be able to interact otherwise. Or if I met them in a honky tonk, certainly not going up to them and talking to them. Mm-hmm. But here I am in the woods. And of course I felt intimidated by them, but they are meeting me and we're like literally meeting at the trailhead. Yeah, it's.
So you led teens out there? How far are you going with these teens?
Oh God, so many. I used to work for a nonprofit where it was essentially like summer camps and we would do adventure trips. We would kayak and canoe, cycle, hike. We do all the things. And yeah, I led many, many groups. It was over several, about like 10 years that I worked with that organization. So yeah, I led many, like I was saying, the crazy things happened, but it was mostly due to the teenagers that I was with all the time.
How do you, are they like arguing with you? Because I did a summer day camp for a local park last summer. And like we have like preteens and like adolescents, and it gets pretty unruly sometimes.
Of course, yeah, of course they argued with me constantly. I think of my time back then, and I try not to be too critical of myself. I was right in my early 20s. I was, you know, leading a lot of my first trips. I was 21 or 22. Like, I didn't know anything about teaching people things. Like, trying to teach somebody how to start a fire in the rain and so that you can cook dinner is like one of maybe the hardest things that you're going to have to do in the woods ever. And so of course it started all kinds of disagreements. I think something I wish I was better at that time was taking those disagreements and turning them into these opportunities for real learning, mm-hmm. and engaging in that way, which is really what the mission of those trips can be when it's done well. And I did get those a lot of the time. A lot of it was really about how you put yourself in difficult situations and you see how you respond. In my writing, I got a lot of inspiration from that. But also, it's just a huge sense of freedom, I think. Even when I was with the kids and we were, you know, maybe we were tired or we didn't want to do whatever we were going to be doing next, there was always a sense of like, yeah, but we could just like stop at the stream and go swimming. And I just don't, the when else am I going to get that in my life? I haven't had it since. And, I don't know if they have. I haven't kept up with all of them, but it's a really beautiful thing to be able to say you did or had for at least a little while.
That seems like an awesome job, though, still.
Cool. I loved it. Yeah. And I would do it in the summer. So I go back to college and then come back in the summer. And I'd basically be gone for, 12 weeks in the summer, do all of that. You can't spend any money because you're out in the woods working. So then when you come back, you like got money to actually be in college and not have to worry about, where you're going to get your next meal.
Did you have any close calls, like with death or anything?
Yeah. A few times. So I should say I went on and worked as kind of I managed the programs as well. So I started creating them and developing them, and it became my role later. Yeah, there were quite a few times when I encountered really dangerous situations where a person's life was at risk. Somehow, I grew up in a household that was really, really unstable. And somehow that ability to think on my feet and to maintain kind of my own safety in those times helped me in those moments. And I always felt like in the moment, I was well equipped to be able to kind of emergency manage the situation and get to safety for whatever kid I was working with. Even having to lead evacuations or carry people out of the wilderness or remove people from the water, those kinds of things. It's the moments after that I think I struggle with the most, and those kind of coming to terms with that sometimes your brain can do all these things and then your body can't catch up. And I did end up feeling that a lot. It's one of the reasons why I left the position around the time of COVID is I had this feeling, or 2020 during the pandemic, I had this feeling of not having really the time to bring the two things together, where I know I was experiencing trauma, but not knowing how to get my body to recognize it and then bring it together. So I've been in therapy for like 2 or 3 years. And it wasn't until I left the job though, that I felt like I could really deal with some of those events that had happened, that it really impacted me.
What did it teach you though about being like a leader? Like, did that help you like create your own press and like you're really taking on this huge like leadership thing and leading people?
I have always felt like it's my life's work to, I hesitate to say that. I don't want it to sound like I'm I don't want to just take care of other people. That's not what my life's work is. But so many times in my life, I felt outcast or left behind, and I say that because I'm queer. We talked about that. I'm also neurodivergent. I'm autistic. I have I know what it's like to feel not placed. Whether it's literally physically, I don't have a place to be, or I'm being excluded from this group, or my experience with writing has been that every group I have turned to be a part of, as far as literary, I have not been welcomed. I was rejected from every MFA program I applied to, and I've been rejected, as we all have, countless times in magazines and for my books. And I guess I say all that to say that my life's work has really become, well, what if I became a space where there was more of that? Yes. Where like you get to show up how you are, you get to be who you are. And we actually really validate that and support that. That means that part of the mission of the press is like, we're seeking out rural writers who are, maybe publishing their first book as like a late debut in their life. Maybe they're queer writers from the South who actually have never even come out. Like they're coming out now as a part of their writing of the book. I want to publish neurodivergent writers, people of color. I want that kind of complexity of the South to be represented in our literature in a way that I think just now Southern literature is finally catching up to. And I want to be a part of that. So yeah, I do think that that's my level of leadership, is that I lead from a place of extreme care and person to person. I truly see each individual that I'm working with as person first and not as a business partner or as a, like, those are all roles we play, right? But but it's important to me, for example, if I'm working with Clint, that I take into account, like, he's got a lot of stuff going on in his life. It's not on me to really, you know, make him do anything for his, you know, work if he doesn't have the time or space for it. So we work with our writers to, typically we have a 1.5 to 2 year on-ramp. So we know that people have lives. Like, writing is not a thing that most people can support themselves doing. Certainly not something that I could do, but you still deserve to create your art. And so how do you fit that into your real life? That's a part of where Loblolly comes in and helps support that.
Were you creating this idea when you're out there with the teens, like thinking about these things when you had the time?
Mm-hmm. Man, I think I was a lot more selfish back then. I think I was thinking a lot about, like, what does this mean to me in these moments of being able to, I mean, truly be part of some of the greatest beauty in all of the world. I do believe that. It's like, I've sat on sides of ponds watching moose, like, swim through the water and come toward me, or beavers even, whatever, if you like that kind of thing. But yes, I was thinking about that. For example, I worked with my favorite group that I ever worked with was a group of 13-year-old boys who were kind of making that transition into high school. And so this was like their last summer before high school. And we went on a hike in New Hampshire, very popular. It's called the Kinsman Range, but it's this, you know, it's a stunning, like, untouched wilderness where they have this beautiful, beautiful pond and where you can camp. And yeah, it's amazing. I remember, I have this vivid memory of kind of sitting next to that pond and having three of the boys come up behind me, sit with me, and like nobody said anything. We just knew that we were like kind of in communion with one another in community. And yeah, so I am thinking about those things of like, okay, when I'm in that moment, I'm thinking, well, I'm really present and I'm appreciative of the moment, but how am I also going to kind of get them to think about that in the context of their lives when they go back? And they, of course, now they have phones and they have, you know, access to all this information all the time. How do I get them to get back to that feeling where they have balance in their lives? Totally. Yeah, I was thinking about it back then too.
It's funny you brought up feeling left out and rejected, and like you went on and created something instead of turning towards anger and resentment and bitterness. I know a lot of like people in the South and writers in the South, there is a feeling of being like left out of like the people in New York or LA, because a lot of times I go into a workshop or something and people just ask me automatically if I'm from LA or New York. I'm like, no, I'm from like Tulsa, Oklahoma. Like, why does it matter?
Do you feel like kind of your regionality and who you are as a writer is based in where you are? And then when they ask you that, it kind of diminishes who you are as a writer?
Not really. I don't really associate Tulsa, like Oklahoma, with my identity. I don't know why. I just like the internet more so.
Yeah, no, totally.
Did you ever find a community online?
That's a good question. I will say, I mean, in leading up to, I met a ton of people in person working that job, right? I spent a long time meeting a lot of like people that I work was coworkers with and became close friends with. Of course, a very transient lifestyle, right? People are coming in and out. So having that online community of, you know, whether we were in a Facebook group together or we were on Instagram, kind of really intentionally building up that community really served me well as a writer when I started. I think a lot of folks, when they followed me on Instagram and I started posting my poetry, that no one knew that I was a poet that I was working with or that I was even writing. My closest friends, of course, knew, but nobody in that community knew. So I did start to feel a little bit like, oh, well, this is a place where I'm feeling pretty, like, people like what I'm writing. And that's kind of nice. Like, I've never had that experience before. And then when I, you know, I self-published my first two books, but when I published my first book, it sold 75 copies. Like, it wasn't reaching across the world. And I was like, wow, I can't believe that I just did that just based on my own community. Like, I built a community, those people like my work, and that's kind of enough for me. Like, I got to put my work out there. And of course, since then, I've become a little bit more kind of savvy in marketing and, you know, business and building my business. But I still see it as a really personal endeavor, even if I'm on the internet engaging with folks. So we have a Substack newsletter. That's been a joy to write and be a part of. I think Substack is a really interesting online space where it at times feels like people are writing with the knowledge that they're on Substack, mm-hmm. while also the content does just feel more lighthearted and maybe more about people's, it feels like kind of the old days of Tumblr, or like maybe the old days of, I don't know, chat rooms, message boards almost, like, yeah. And in a way that I think Reddit doesn't really feel like anymore in my, like, it feels like it's become so mainstream. I don't know.
But. Can you talk about some of the ideas that you've done through your website? Like, I saw there's like a writer fund.
Yeah, we got a couple of cool initiatives. So, you know, Helene was the hurricane relief scene being one, but then we've had a couple of big changes this year where we migrated our site over to Shopify, which has really helped us like gain, essentially it's just easier to sell things there, which is nice, but also gives me more options as to what I can sell. So I work with a lot of writers, right? And when we travel to go on book tours, essentially we break even a lot of the time on traveling to get somewhere to sell 10 books. And then we've, you know, made no money. And I started thinking about that as like, well, what if we had like a fund that we could pull from that writers could use to travel and to go places? And so our merch ecosystem was born from that. And basically 10% of our merch sales go into that fund for writers that they can pull from. It's not a formal place. The writers do not have to write like a request. I keep everything. There's no gatekeeping here. If they need it, they reach out to me. I've got a one-on-one basis with all of them, and we're able to do that. The fund's pretty small right now, but it's something that as we create better and better merch, I think is going to sell. We have a really exciting new tote. Can I show you? I'm not a fan of making junk just to be sold. So I wanted it to be something that I knew I would want to use. So I bought these like canvas totes. They're very heavy, very like heavy duty and big enough to hold many, many books. I use it for like, I have a co-working space and I'll put everything in here. But I just like ironed on a little patch and, you know, I just wanted to feel like it's something people would really use. So those are on our site. We got these hot tub hats that Emma designed that
I have one.
Did you get one? Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I love this thing. So yeah, we've got like a lot of little things going on the side.
How many of the hats did you make?
I did not make the hat. So Emma printed out or made them. I don't know how many she made. I have a few more here. And then I use for the Loblolly press hats, I use kind of a print on demand style where like I'll bring five in. When five sell, I'll buy five more, that kind of thing. They're expensive. It's like, I don't have that kind of money sitting around just to be stocking up on merch that takes time, you know?
Do you have any other ideas? Like,
in the... Yeah. Oh my gosh, I got so many ideas. I'm scared to share them though. What if I don't do them?
I mean, that happens a lot of the time.
Yeah, I do. I'd love to do understory every year. I think that would be a really cool community-based thing. Ideally, I'd have some kind of quarterly book box that people could either purchase or subscribe to, where they felt like they could get... We release, essentially right now, our release schedule is like three quarters of the year, we release one book. And then we take the winter to do submissions. So I would love to have like a quarterly box where everybody gets like the book that comes out that quarter, a piece of merch associated with it. Part of the idea with the tote is that we're going to design patches for every single book that we release so that you can like buy the patch that goes with the book and then you can put it on your bag. Trying to create that sense like that. I'm honestly trying to create things that like I think are cool and that I'd like to do. And whether that's corny or not, it's like, I would like to have a few patches and stickers for things that I would put on my stuff. And so, yeah, like some kind of book box every quarter would be cool. And we could also, part of what I was thinking with the book box is I'd love to partner with other like Southern local organizations to do things like tea boxes where people can get tea and also a book and a patch and a, you know, piece of merch. Or we've got Asheville Tea Company here, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but they're incredible. They make delicious tea. Yeah, we've got a lot of like cool little shops. A lot of queer-owned shops. We have a queer-owned thrift store. Yeah, so I'd love to partner with folks like that.
What's your favorite place in Asheville that you would hold like an event at? And who would you like if you could invite like any famous author that's like from the South?
Yeah,
who would you invite?
Well, I would invite Jesmyn Ward. I'd love Jesmyn Ward. I'd love to have her come to Asheville and do an event. I mean, a dream, she'd do an event with us. That'd be incredible. Favorite place. So I will say I'm kind of sad because Plebe Urban Winery was like my spot in town. And it's actually where my husband and I had our like celebration for our wedding and everything. And it's actually like the building is gone. Like there's nothing left. And I would love, like, if I could go back in time and have like a book event there, they're amazing. I don't know if they're going to rebuild, but they made incredible wine. They had an incredibly comforting, warm space, and they would host like, you know, they would host, you know, trivia and things like that. But I would love to do a reading there. I would like to do something like Harvest Records. They have like a performance space and they sell records, and it's like, it'd be cool to do a book launch with some sort of music component as well at one of those places. And then I'm not religious at all, but the idea of hosting kind of a book reading in a church, especially for someone maybe who doesn't align with that kind of sense of religion, like I would like to do that for myself, even just to have that kind of juxtaposition of a little bit of like counterculture, but also like it's where we live and also we're surrounded by it. And here's my art that kind of goes against that would be a really cool. Yeah. I do love sacred spaces in that way. So it would be neat to do that.
How was coming out for you?
Yeah. It took me too long. It took me a long time. I mean, maybe not too long, but I feel like people are coming out earlier and earlier these days, which is great. Or they're just being, people are just being, which I think is good. I came out in college first to my brother. And he was, he didn't care. He's a little bit younger than me, but he did care. He was like, I'm so glad you told me. But in the sense that I didn't face any sort of discrimination from him. And then, you know, shortly after, my grandmother kind of like brought me to a Mexican restaurant just to have, we would go to have dinner occasionally together. And I was raised by my grandparents. And she, you know, she was just asking me and kind of poking and prodding. And then finally was like, are you gay? And I was like, yeah, I am. So that kind of like process for me, I never felt like I had like I never did that. Do you remember that thing on the internet where it was like everybody was having like the coming out videos and they were on YouTube or whatever? I never had that moment where I felt like I did that to my whole family or something. I just started living queer. Like I just started dating men, and then people would be like, oh, he's gay. And then it would just kind of be that. Yeah, but I think the things that I faced were not in coming out, but they've been in like trying to just continue to exist. I think especially as I continue to play with my own gender and feel like I do feel like gender. I came out when I didn't even like have a concept of what gender was. So I felt like I was just gay and that was it. I think as I've gotten older and as I've, you know, have a lot of trans friends, I think that they're part of my community, and I have been exposed now to, oh, maybe my gender is like maybe a little more fluid than I thought it was. And how does that manifest itself is something I'm still exploring. So I think I'm also in kind of the middle of another coming out where I'm not trans or non-binary, but I also feel like my gender doesn't sit all the way toward being a man or being a woman. It sits somewhere in between. And I like that. And I feel like Asheville is the place where I feel safe doing that, but I'm not sure that I would do it in other places. Maybe one day when I'm a little more like confident. But
have you ever done drag for like Halloween?
I guess I did. I did. I didn't call it drag, but I was Princess Di 2 years ago for
awesome
Halloween. It was a blast. I bought these huge, I was like Princess Di but with stripper heels. So I bought these huge stripper heels, and I had a friend like cut a piece of a dress. So I had like a black little like dress, and then I had the pearls, and yeah, it was super fun. I didn't know, like, think of it as drag at the time, but looking back, I'm like, well, that is drag. I'm a huge fan of drag, by the way. I think I will say this, what you can call it corny, but like RuPaul's Drag Race was part of my coming out experience, and seeing queer people on screen, because I binged every season, every episode, and still do. I don't keep up with all of the franchises. There's quite a few, but I feel like I came out in that way. Like I started understanding, oh, you can be this, you can do this. But growing up in the South, especially in a really rural community, and because I grew up in two different rural communities and then, you know, moved north and was still rural there, but I never felt like I was exposed to gay people, much less what it could look like to be gay. All of the things that could mean.
I was thinking about this because I've read some of Emma's stories, like from her book, like online and stuff. Would you consider it like a queer book, because it is, a lot of the stories are about childhood. And I was thinking, like, you know, being gay, like a lot of the times when I think about friend groups, I always go back, I revert back to like when I was growing up, because a lot of like politics and interested in other genders like kind of weren't there.
Yes.
So maybe that's a weird subversive way to look at the book.
I think it is definitely. So it's a queer book by nature being written by someone that is queer.
Yeah.
And I think that lens of being existing in the world, I find that if I go, so I'm just about myself for a second, but if I go to write a queer book, it's really hard. It's mm-hmm. impossible. If I just sit down and write poetry or write, you know, prose or whatever I want to write, it by nature kind of comes out of me because it's who I am. I think that's what happens with Emma's work too. I'm not sure that she sits down and says, I'm going to write, you know, queerness into the story, but yeah, you can see it all throughout the computer room. Man, I'm so excited for you guys to grab onto it. It's just, yeah, like you said, I know you read a few of the stories, but the kind of way that it just reminds me of so many, like I keep a few like little short story collections around because it's one of my favorite ways to read. And I just feel so proud that it's like on the shelf next to it. And I'm like, wow, I can't believe like we found each other and now we were going to put this like beautiful thing out into the world. So.
She kind of came out of nowhere. Like she just started writing like during like COVID and then she just started putting out stories like on Joyland and stuff. There's like major publications. It's like, where did she come from? Even though like she was already in this community that I was part of.
I think that she kind of embedded herself on purpose and then started getting mentors. And, you know, I do think a lot of what I've noticed about my experience just in building literary community is the more people that I talk to and the more people that I connect with, it seems like the more I have an in certain places. And I guess I've never been like into the playing the game of like trying to know people and kind of, you know, get clout and all those things. And I still don't do that, but I'm really intentional about like the people that I engage with so that I then feel like, oh, wow, we're like building, we're all in the same mission together. I think Emma probably did that and felt like she then was inspired by the people around her. I mean, she's an artist in so many other ways too, right? Graphic design, painter, you know, and so writer on top of all of that. Yeah. And I think that was part of my, that was part of the appeal when we were talking, as I was like, you bring so much and like, you're already contributing in so many ways. We just need to give you a platform to share your writing to a wider audience.
Would you ever help her make a movie out of her book?
Sure. I'd help her make a movie, but I will say I'm not a filmmaker. But I love small films, especially. I think of one of my favorite poets is Frank Stanford, and he was from Arkansas, but he would just make these kind of weird abstract films based on his poems. I love that stuff. I mean, I'm not sure that I like seek it out as a person who wants to watch it for everyone, but I think it would be super cool to do some kind of either reading of one of her stories that has some sort of visual component would be amazing. Same for the poets that I'm working with too.
At what point, you said you were applying to MFAs, at what point did you stop and like, I'm going to do my own thing? Because you sound really intellectual, like you're kind of academic.
Yeah, I have lots of thoughts and I like to, I mean, this conversation honestly is so filling to me that I don't get this kind of in-depth back and forth a lot. And so that's what I was looking for with an MFA. I knew I left school for a while. I loved undergrad, but I did not like school. Like I had a good time, but I was so burnt out with the writing and the reading. It just felt like everything was a rat race and that's not how I live. Like I try to be as relaxed as I can. Like I have a lot of hobbies and a lot of interests, and I don't want any one thing to take up too much time. But I felt like there was a point at which I had to make a decision where I was writing a lot. It felt like it was a big part of my life, and I was either going to make the jump to a wider audience and actually make the jump to like being a better writer, or I wasn't, and I was just going to stop. And I don't know. Maybe my thought was like, well, if I just had a little bit of credibility from an MFA program, maybe I could do it. I had already published two books before this. Like I had done all of that and I was kind of looking at my next step. And I really wanted feedback in a group that I could just look to for community and writing. I don't know if people know, but it's very expensive to apply for MFA programs. And my friend and I were going to try to go to the same school, although she was going to be applying for the doctoral programs in English and I was going to be applying for the MFA programs. And, you know, we applied to all the same schools and they got into a lot of them. I'm happy that they did. It was amazing, but I got into none. We applied to 8 different schools and spent over $1,000 on applications. And
whoa.
Yeah. And I look back on it and I think, wow, I think I would have been really unhappy in those programs. Like, I don't think that my space, I honestly think I'm a little too do it yourself for an MFA program. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't actually, besides the people that I consider part of my like editorial crew, where I have like people that read my work and people that are interested in kind of giving me feedback, I've built that slowly over time. I don't really seek that kind of outside validation. I don't even submit to journals. I don't want to. I think it's a game that if that's your route, that's totally fine. I don't want to spend my time writing a poem that I then send out to a journal and I wait 6 months to hear back, and I send it to actually 10 journals and I wait to hear back from them. And then I'm getting, you know, published in a journal that has maybe a little bit of circulation and I get no bump actually from my audience. It just felt like I was doing it and it was a waste of my time. So I was like, well, why don't I just do it on my own? And that's kind of where the ethos of Lavalley comes about. It's like, why don't we just do it on our own? And it's hard. It's very hard. There's nothing easy about it. But I feel like everything I put my time into is actually, it produces something. Something comes of it in a way that I didn't feel like that was happening with applying for the MFAs or working in the journals and trying to apply there.
In your chapbook about like the bears and being hunted, do you relate to being hunted or being the hunter?
I literally see people in the queer community being actually hunted. Like, I think right now we are actually being hunted out.
Oh yeah.
No, I don't feel hunted. I don't in particular feel like it right now. I know several of my friends who do. And it's hard for me to say, like, that actually makes me emotional using that language and that word, but I think that's what I'm trying to parse out in my writing, is it is that severe. It is that strong. When you talk about, this is a weird, it's like, I don't agree, you know, with everything that goes on in the military and like that whole thing, like we just can put a blanket over that. But when we talk about finding trans people in the military and forcibly removing them, well, that sounds a lot like hunting them. Mm-hmm. And I think when we talk about not allowing trans athletes to play certain sports or to be on certain teams, or not allowing drag to happen in the streets, I think that that's, yeah, we're being hunted.
Mm-hmm.
I, as hard as it is to say out loud and as hard as it is to parse through, and what I hope comes out in the poems is like, this is not new. Like, we've been dealing with this forever, and we will keep, like, it will continue to happen. And what we can depend on right now is our community, the people that we love. You know, I think a lot about how Helene devastated us. We were left feeling completely alienated from those around us. No cell service, literally not able to talk to anyone. And I met my neighbors like for the first time. And I think about that being similar to this, where community is actually the thing that upholds us, right? So, for example, like applying to FEMA and getting, you know, whatever little bit of money they wanted to give us. And then my experience has been that post that, literally fighting for every single dollar that we could try to get back from them and getting denied time after time after time. That level of government is not here to help us, and it hasn't been. And so what do we have? We have like our people, and that's a wide circle still. I'm not saying it's like we have to be tribal about it. I'm saying that it's more likely that your community members around you are actually going to lift up and support you. My friends and my community and folks helped raise over $2,000 so that my husband and I could be in a different place for a month. And I think of that as like, but you know, that came from people at my job and from everywhere else and around my life. And yeah, those are the people that came out to support us. Not our government resources, not none of those people. So
I feel like the government's like exacting like psychological trauma on people by like not giving them aid for like, that's what they're there to do.
Yeah, and I will say I've been on the phone with FEMA for a long time. Because I have the time, I work from home, and I'm like, I'm going to call you up and I'm going to sit on hold and I'm going to wait and talk to somebody. The people that are working there are wonderful. Like, they literally are being like handcuffed in their ability to help you. Truly, like, behind barriers, like, of, like, I actually can't see your application. I can't see who it's been sent to. I can't see, like, all of those things. So I actually don't really, I blame the bureaucracy more than I blame, like, the people who are actually working there, and just, like, the inability of the actual organization to really do anything, probably because of the amount of funding that's been cut from doing it. When I realized that FEMA is actually, like, an organization where it employs people who actually work in different federal departments so that they can, like, have a workforce, I was like, so what is your, what is the point of this place then? Like, you don't fund it, you don't staff it. So what is it actually there for? And I don't know. I think other people would have different opinions than I do, but yeah, this is something I've been kind of on a tirade about recently.
Can I ask why the name Loblolly?
Yeah. Well, I love trees. Loblolly pine is a very southern pine. It's, in particular, it's a pine that has an incredibly, it's incredibly tall, incredibly skinny. So a lot of trees can fit in one place. It has a history of being really easy to log. So I kind of like that idea of what we were growing is, you know, fragile, that feeling of it. But also that the reason that it's as tall as it is and the reason it grows so close to others is because that it, when wind comes or when storms come, they actually hold each other up by supporting each other in the canopy. And I don't know, I felt like that metaphor was a good one for what we're trying to do, especially in the South. And yeah, we got our little pine cone, we got our little, like, you know, tree stuff going on. And yeah, it just feels very, it was very organic. I didn't, like, sit down and decide that I wanted it to be a really super meaningful thing. It just came to me as I was actually talking with Earl. Like I said, we published his first book, but he helped me come up with it. We were trying to find some bird names and then started talking about trees, and that kind of the trees kind of started to take root literally. And we started to feel like that was the one that we should go with. I also like how it rolls off the tongue, and yeah, feels like it kind of echoes as you say it.
Do you think in 10 years, when you look back on starting Loblolly, that the hurricane will become part of the story?
Totally. Yeah, and I say that because I think it's definitely the most traumatic event of my adult life. Definitely, like, that's part of it. But also the support that comes out, that came out for us, was just, it was really mind-blowing. I didn't expect it, and didn't have any, I didn't have any expectations that it would be like that. I think it'll be part of our foundation as, like, how we grew. And also motivated me to be like, wow, people are kind of hungry for something that I want to create, and that my writers are creating, and we're doing that together.
I guess I'll end it on this Emma analogy I thought of. I thought it was kind of ironic that she's putting out a book about, you know, maybe kind of experiences surrounding her childhood, even though it's fiction. But then at the same time, like, right now, in reality, she's getting hit with this hurricane, and having to be, like, this life-changing event. She's really having to be an adult and be independent. And it's like these two parallels or juxtapositions going on.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on. This has been awesome.
Yeah, it was a great interview. Thank you.
No problem. I have a lot of interviews to put up. It'll probably come out, like, in a month or something. I'll let you know.
You're a great interviewer. Where did you learn to do this?
I just ask questions. I don't know. I'm curious. I'm annoying.
You really just come up with them as you go? You don't, like... Mm-hmm. As I was nervous, I was like, do I need to see the questions beforehand or anything? And you were like, let's just show up. And I'm like, wow, that's cool that you can... I do the Loblolly Press podcast now. And I'm having a really hard time doing what you're doing, which is just kind of...
Really?
I'm very curious. I mean, I love questions, but yeah, it's hard for me to kind of improv them as I go.
Yeah, I think it's a great podcast. I really like it.